Hey, you guys, it's your host, Tayshia. So if you're listening to the Classical Classroom podcast, it's likely that you're aware that there is a world of classical music out there and that it's got something to do with these guys, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms. Most of it was written a really long time ago, all that good stuff. And you may have wondered how on earth that music is related to this more avant-garde experimental world of music out there that also calls itself classical, like Philip Glass and John Cage. Well, in this episode, cellist Ashley Bathgate explains that link, and she kind of gives a primer on what's going on in the new classical music world and what it's kind of lending to the world of classical music as a whole. I learned a ton by talking to Ashley. It was really fun, and I hope you learn a lot too. I think you will. When you do, when you're like, oh my God, it's like I've gotten a free education, because you have, make sure you go on over to iTunes or wherever you listen and you subscribe to, rate, and review the show. It makes a whole lot of difference for us, and it takes you like 2 seconds. I mean, come on. Okay, and now a word from our sponsor. This episode of Classical Classroom is sponsored by Maestro Classics. Visit maestroclassics.com today to take advantage of their Cyber Monday sale. All CDs with 24-page activity books, regularly priced at $16.98, are on sale for only $9.98 and include free shipping. You can also get the Maestro Classics 12-CD box set, an excellent gift for the holidays, for only $89.95. Visit maestroclassics.com today and give the gift of classical music this holiday season. Not a bad idea. All right, and now on with the show. There's a rumor going around that classical music can be hoity-toity. But here in the classical classroom, we beg to differ.
Beethoven 5.
The idea that classical music is a zone where we have to feel restricted or we have to act in a certain way, you know, that's not going to be helpful going forward.
Isaiah is shaking with excitement.
Oh, here. I mean, there's just so many great parts of the opera.
He asked me to play his favorite spot in the first movement of the Brahms. And then he said, I started using those licks in my guitar solos.
How to be classical music rock stars, because there's not enough of that in this business.
Occasionally, I would plug in the mandolin to my distortion pedals.
I don't change my voice.
And talking to classical
voice. I'm playing classical music now. I mean, it's the same 12 notes. That's what's so cool about it.
I'm Tayshia Clay, a classical music newbie, and I'm trying to learn all I can about the music. Come learn with me and the classical music experts I invite into the Classical Classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Tayshia Clay, and here with me today is cellist Ashley Bathgate. In addition to Ashley's solo work, which she's here in Seattle touring, Ashley is probably best known for being a member of the Bang on a Can All-Stars. She's also part of the chamber group Howl, as well as a duo Two Cents and the quintet called Bonjour. Ashley, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I just got to hear your super cool performance on the cello in our CD library. Thanks so much
I'm really happy I got to do it here.
And what was the name of that piece again?
It's called Paraso, which is the name of my cello teacher from Yale.
That is so cool. And you brought your pug with you.
I did, Dita. She's my buddy.
So cute.
And now she's your buddy.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
She's got a very fetching sweater for the cold weather. So it's interesting, this new music festival, which I think this is their first go.
Yeah, this is inaugural.
It got me thinking a little about new classical music. And on Classical Classroom, we've done several music specifically about new classical music, like Nico Muhly, Missy Mazzoli, Starkland Records, people like that.
My friends.
By the way, what we've never talked about with regard to new classical, though, is that there are these parts of it that people don't really think of as classical. There are things that you use to make the music, like loop pedals, but then there are also things about how the music is composed and the techniques that are used to play it and stuff. I was hoping we could talk about that today.
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Let's start with the tech. What are things that you incorporate into the music, and what are things that you've seen other people do, things you'd like to try?
So I use mostly Ableton Live and Max for Live. They're both software programs. Hmm. And that allows me to use plugins and effects on my sound. I have an interface, you know, that my microphone goes into, which feeds into my computer and allows for live processing and that kind of integration. I have done some looping, though there are much more experienced and more brilliant loopers out there. So I think that's something that I want to do more of, kind of hone that skill a little bit. And I think now that I've kind of, I won't say mastered, but got a grip on software land, I'm interested in probably getting some good hardware and some pedals.
Yeah.
I have a pretty nice fuzz box that I love when I do Michael Gordon's Industry, but I want to have that pedal board.
Yeah.
And I play with an amazing guitarist, Mark Stewart, in Bang in a Can, and yeah. So he's feet away from me every show, and I'm drooling over his candy on the floor, you know, that he uses for all of these effects. And in general, that's why I got into using electronics in the first place, because, you know, I've played cello for a very long time. Certainly in contemporary music, we are asked to do a lot of what we call extended techniques, which might be different sounds on the instrument that you wouldn't consider traditional. We can talk more about that.
Yeah.
But then using amplification is a whole other world and allows for a different color palette.
Mm-hmm.
And using pedals in addition, I mean, for guitarists, it's kind of essential. Like, that's their color palette, right? You have your sound, and then you build on that with whatever you need to. And I watch him use these things in such a musical way and with such purpose. And so I think that as a string player, that's something I would like to be more versed in, is that I have so much I can call from my own technique and skill sets, but that is another palette that I want in my repertoire, in my wheelhouse. So maybe that's something to strive for. But at the moment, I'm working with these software programs, and that's a pretty transportable rig. You know, you're talking just a laptop, interface, microphone, some in-ear monitors. And so composers write, I commission a lot of music, and they write with me in mind. And a lot of composers today are using Max MSP, which is a composition in and of itself. So let's say you write a piece of music for a cellist, but then you're also writing a software patch, which is basically a visual coding and mapping one thing to another, and allows you to kind of specify and make very specifically the kind of like range and timing of the effects, or it can get very complicated. And then for someone like me who is not trained in that software program, they've made it very easy by sending me this patch, which I integrate through Ableton, and I'm able to do the piece that way with live processing. So one of the pieces I'm playing on this tour is by Yasha Narvison, called Flash Crash, and he has a really complicated setup, but it's easy for me. I just open the project and I plug in and I trigger some things with my feet. So I have a MIDI controller that allow me to trigger effects, advance the music. And there's a certain element too with live processing that allows for spontaneity and improvisation that I like a lot.
Really cool. You know, as you were talking, something that came to mind was the fact that the game changers for classical music over the years, at least from what I know, have been the ability to project sound, how guitar sort of fell out of favor.
That's right.
When symphony orchestras began playing in these big halls and you like couldn't hear the guitar. Or the fact that chamber music is usually played in a smaller room because that's how it sounds best. You know, you can hear the strings playing and all the instruments playing. So I was thinking about like, how has this technology changed things in that way? Like what kind of venues are you now able to play in and stuff like that?
That's a big conversation, actually. I think it's good and bad. I think everything has pros and cons. I would say it's not even just tech, but this always the feeling of bigger, better, louder, right?
Hmm.
And so you're right. As it's evolved and concert spaces are larger and audience to, you know, accommodate larger audiences and such. Even as a cellist, I know that from playing concertos with orchestra, it's really hard to project, you know. So then instrument makers started making louder instruments, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you buy a louder instrument, you can compete with that. But you still kind of can't override a whole symphony orchestra all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think composers aren't necessarily always tuned into balance the way that maybe some of the more classical composers were, because they didn't have microphones and everything. There's a sort of expectation, well, we have the technology, so we're going to write how we want to write, and then we'll see, and we'll tweak it that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that can be good in many ways, because it certainly gives me freedom. You know, if I have a microphone and someone else is able to control my sound and means I don't have to force, I can play the dynamic range that I want. You know, if I'm playing in a bigger venue, a concerto, and I really want to achieve a pianissimo or something very soft or floaty sounding, I really can't do that unless the orchestra is willing to come down to absolutely nothing, which is not always the case. And, you know, you kind of have to exaggerate everything.
Yeah.
With amplification and with effects, I think you don't have to.
Mm.
I can play what's written. I can play within a huge dynamic range and count on the fact that a sound engineer is going to ride the faders and make it all work. And that's another thing, though. It becomes very much a duo. Like, my solo concerts are really not solo, they're duo. If you have a sound engineer, like, that is the person who's making it all happen. And it's super important. Bang & McCann also, we have two sound engineers that we travel with, and so thankful for them, you know, for making it so easy for us. And so that's another thing. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah.
And you were asking about venues. I think music is changing so that we have to adapt to a lot of different surroundings, and what constitutes a concert hall is very different. Now it can be a rock club. It can be a living room.
Yeah.
It can be a huge, you know, space like Carnegie Hall.
Hmm.
But Carnegie Hall is not the normal. You know, that's not where we're playing most of our concerts. I think most concerts are happening in smaller venues and also weirder places, you know, like, let's say outdoors, or you have an installation or museums where you play. And technology has made that a lot easier, you know, making things more portable and being able to set up a sound system in a space that otherwise might not accommodate live music.
Yeah, I was just thinking about like Matt Heimovitz, like being the first classical music to play at CBGB's, which is, you know, a rock venue that's famous for punk bands like the Ramones and stuff like that.
Right.
And here he is with the cello.
Playing some Hendrix. I once saw him at Cafe, you know, when I was really young, actually. And he was doing like Star Spangled Banner and Hendrix style. It was really awesome.
Yeah.
He was a pioneer of that. And very
well, I'm guessing that took a lot of tech for that to happen, because a club is meant for, you know, amplified instruments.
Maybe and maybe not. You know, he doesn't play with a lot of effects.
Huh.
So he actually, I think, went acoustic in a lot of situations like that.
Yeah.
Unabashedly, you know, kind of like, this is what it is.
Huh.
I can play here too.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, most clubs would have a microphone or an amp that you could run through. But I'm guessing that it started out pretty basic in terms of that. And from that starting point, you know, we've like everything else, complicated things rather than all this other stuff. But simpler, in my experience, is better in that regard, especially when you're touring and traveling. You don't want to get too complicated with it all because it's always a different venue. It's a different situation, you know, sound checks and troubleshooting. And if it starts, you start getting overloaded with effects and processing and all this stuff, that can be really fun, but not always practical. Mm-hmm. So I have kind of a line, you know, that I draw where it's like, all right, that's just enough for me and for what I want to achieve and put out there musically. Also, I want my sound to be as authentic as possible and not over-processed or over-affected. You know, that it's still as much a natural cello sound as you can get, or if I'm singing vocally, that it's real and it's me and not just me on stage, but you're hearing something that's gone through so many different tubes and wires to sound like something completely different, I guess.
But can you think of a few pieces of classical music that have really benefited from involving kinds of tech, effects pedals and what have you?
Well, industry, I mean, the music of Michael Gordon, industry is a piece that he wrote for solo cello and distortion. And typically the sound engineer is controlling the distortion, so it kind of comes in as a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts out as this acoustic sound that gets more and more warped and changed.
Yeah.
So for me, that was one of the first pieces that I played with effects, and it was really transformative, and I think I felt I had this huge sound that I never would have had, and I had this distortion, right? This kind of, with these overtones and difference tones, you know, like that you kind of hear the lower frequency below the note. I'd never heard that before, and I couldn't believe that my instrument was producing those sounds that you wouldn't hear if I just played acoustically. You would only hear that through a pickup and, you know, this pedal. That was big for me. Another piece, more symphonic work that he wrote called Weather, also incorporates distortion and kind of other audio effects and sampling. And I remember when I first joined Bang & Akin, I listened to that piece and thought, oh my God, like that's the coolest thing. Because the first movement of it is so sort of Vivaldi, Bach fugue reminiscent. So it really, you know, getting back to what you were saying about classical music, this actually does tie into tradition and structure, kind of harkens back to that music, yet it spins it in a totally different direction because you've got all these different effects happening on the back end. So one of the other pieces that I heard, of course, Steve Reich wrote all of these counterpoint. There's piano counterpoint, cello counterpoint, Vermont counterpoint for flute, violin counterpoint, and maybe one of the more famous ones is electric counterpoint, which is for electric guitars. I think it's 8 electric.
It's such a cool piece.
Many guitarists have done, like, they've made different versions of it. They've done it in a live scenario where we have all 8 people playing live. So that also, hearing that kind of multi-tracking, which was, you know, I think you're talking like in the 90s and early aughts when these pieces were written. And at that time, you would like bring a CD, right? And be like, play this and I'll play along. And now it's different. You send a MP3 or an AIFF file, or you integrate it into your own software and can play all 8 channels at the same time. Thank you. was huge for me to see someone, and really inspiring why I actually started doing more solo recitals, because I got very excited that I didn't have to be just one voice. Mm-hmm. I could be 8. I could be 15. This piece, Paraso, that I just recorded here, you know, that's 11 cellos. And then you perform the solo, you know, line over that orchestra of yourself. And it's also something you build from the ground up, right? I go into the studio and I build it from the bass line up and just kind of get it just right. And so I've built this thing that I then put into my live performances. Like making chamber music and having an orchestra, but being a solo performer.
So I'm taking a little break from my chat with Ashley Bathgate to tell you about our new website, because it's super freaking cool. It's at classicalclassroomshow.com. It's got some awesome new features, such as free downloadable lesson plans and study guides for you teachers out there. You can also find all of our back episodes. You can connect with us on the social medias. And now there's a little button that says Tip Jar, where you can leave us a one-time or recurring gift if you want to support the work we do on the podcast. I'm talking like $1 or $3, and you get little thingies for it too. And if you want a website that's as cool as ours, good luck. Just kidding. You should actually contact our friends at New Y. They made it for us, and they can make you a great site too. They can also help you promote it. For more information about New Y, go to classicalclassroomshow.com/NW. That's N as in new and W as in Y. All right, now back to my chat with Ashley Bathgate. From a compositional point of view, I know that you and your various co-performers and your various projects, you commission new works by living composers. I guess you wouldn't be commissioning works by dead composers, because that would be weird and awkward. I want to talk about like some of the less orthodox things that you're seeing there. Like, what kind of things are people doing in new compositions that they maybe haven't done in the past?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, for me, when I first started playing contemporary music in school, it was still considered 20th century. So, for instance, Schoenberg was contemporary music. And of course, Cage, Lachenmann, even Stokowski. So there were all these, what is classical music? You know, what is new music? Yeah. Blurry. And I think what started to happen in the 20th century, not only 12-tone and serial composition, but then beyond that, so use of different intonation systems, like playing in just intonation or tempered. Tempered would be like the piano, how a piano is tuned, which mm-hmm. is kind of what we consider normal in the Western world. Just intonation or like Pythagorean tuning is maybe more East, or what you would hear in Indian classical music.
Okay.
It's kind of like it's all about sense. Right? So how sharp or flat a note is, microtonality, the relationships of the notes to each other, the intervals, like a third or a fourth, you know, perfect fourths, perfect fifths, but thirds tuned differently. Mm. It's how you hear it. So to our ears, it would be a little strange, but it's actually this very organic, resonating kind of tuning system. And that spills into conversation about like overtones and undertones and difference tones and like why things vibrate the way they do, like why frequencies might be more intense, or when they're absolutely perfect, they're huge sounding, and when they're not so perfect, it might not resonate as clearly. Mm-hmm. That is kind of, in my opinion, extended technique, and like where a lot of music, especially when we started merging East and West and embracing world music and different styles and genres, mm-hmm. we did just that. We embraced it, and we kind of said, oh yeah, that can be new music too. And that is also a classical style. So it evolves in this really beautiful way. And then, of course, you have really imaginative composers who invent things. Like, they invent not only different sounds, you know, playing on the other side of the bridge, scratch tone, you know, like embracing what maybe you would call ugly, you know, or okay. noise.
Yeah.
That's now music. You know, making, I have composers ask me all the time, no, I want it dirtier.
Yeah.
I want that, no, I don't want the pitch to come through, or no, I want that like out of tune, that's great. Or I want that really thin, raspy sound.
Yeah.
So sort of embracing all of the different ways that the instrument can make sound. So mm-hmm. it's not this classically trained version of itself anymore. It's sort of embracing imperfection in a really beautiful way. So there are those things, playing with ponticello, which is playing near the bridge, and you get a very naturally distorted sound by doing that. So I could play my cello for you acoustically without any effect on it and have it imitate what distortion sounds like.
Okay.
Or playing very close to the fingerboard, or even way, way up, you know, towards the halfway mark on the string between the end of the fingerboard and the scroll of the cello, and there are these nodes and places where it resonates in a funky way.
I just learned about something called wolf tone.
Oh, yeah. Wolf tones are like a cellist's worst enemy.
Okay, these are bad. We don't want these.
We don't want them yet. Yet, it's a really super cool sound.
Yeah,
I'm sure
okay.
somebody's going to write a piece for me one day that's all about my cello's wolf tones. It's the way the wood is vibrating, and usually the shape, like the shape of a cello, how the air is resonating in it. And it's like two frequencies that are almost identical, but they're clashing somehow. And so they're rubbing up against each other, and they're kind of creating this. So you have like, it's usually on an F or an F sharp below middle C, where you get this kind of ugly, wolfy sound.
And this is apparently like a problem that all cellists have.
It's mostly a cello problem, and we have wolf eliminators.
Wolf eliminators.
You know, yeah. There's a whole market for like the ways to alleviate and get rid of your wolf tone. So anyway, there are all these extended techniques, and this comes through improvisation and through minds, you know, experimenting and being just having crazy ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, then you have the musical language, which is how do we notate that?
Uh-huh.
How do we write this down? We can't just write paragraphs and paragraphs on a score explaining exactly what we mean. Sometimes I find that very helpful. I like when composers do that. But you know, you've got to find your language. So now even notation is what is standard is changing. You have like squiggle marks and, you know, how to notate certain types of glissandi, how to notate different kinds of vibrato and ponticello. There's like molto sul pont and poco sul pont and frog and here and there and stutter bow. Like Andrew Norman, one of the composers, I play a lot of his music. He's invented, I think, his own sound world and language, you know, with like stutter bow. So it almost sounds like if you were really nervous and you're pulling the bow across the string and you get this like but it's this beautiful, like very fragile sound. You know, how do we notate this? So composers of these scores are becoming works of art. It's like this graphic notation that we haven't seen. And a lot of times, you know, certainly with more complicated music, it really takes a long time for a performer to kind of digest that, learn those new terms and symbols, memorize them, master them, incorporate them, interpret them.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, especially when you're commissioning and collaborating with composers, you're in a sense helping them, you know, discover things. So they might ask me to do something, And then I do what I think they're telling me to do, and it's something totally different. And either they say, oh, I hate that, or I love that. How, what is that? What are you doing? Like, so you kind of volley back and forth. And at the end of it, you have this new piece of music that we've kind of collaborated on. And that's part of why I love playing contemporary music, too, is because dead composers are dead composers. You can't really collaborate or talk to them mm-hmm. or ask them, well, what did you mean? You can only interpret.
Yeah.
With living composers, I can actually ask them. You know, it's very right. easy to email them or Skype them or have them there in person. And certainly when they're writing for you, you know, I've been in wonderful situations at retreats and residencies where you're actually in the room together before the piece is even written. And I remember Ted Hearn, I commissioned him to write a cello and percussion piece, and he came to me with this idea of a wine cork mm-hmm. in between the strings. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, try, and whips out his iPhone and says, let's record some, let's just see all the different sounds you can make with this wine cork, moving it up and down between the fingerboard and the bridge, putting it in between different strings, playing pizzicato, playing arco on either side of the cork.
What's arco?
Arco is playing with the bow. Okay. So the more like sort of sustained right. lyrical sound, and then you have pits, which is plucking the strings.
Mm-hmm.
And with the cork, you get these really cool gong sounds mm. almost, and it distorts the pitch. It changes it entirely. If you move it up or down, the pitch changes. So all this really cool yeah. stuff, you know. And then we work together on that. He takes what he likes from it, writes a piece, you know. You know, and I'm playing with a percussionist on that particular work. And I thought he did a really magical job of making a cello almost into a percussive instrument, you know,
mm-hmm.
And having us echo each other in really interesting and different ways. So there's yeah. just this idea of what is classical, what is new. It's just ever evolving and ever changing. And they're just words, you know.
Yeah. But it sounds like what I'm kind of hearing you say is that the what's happened, like how classical music has evolved, and the is kind of like the way that the whole world has evolved, and that we're all like, and how culture has evolved, that we're all so connected now.
I think so.
It sounds like the same is being expressed in classical music in like so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And its language and its incorporation of sound from other countries in terms of like weird stuff you put in your instrument to make it make sounds. Just the idea of what the music can be has kind of come out of a box.
Yeah, there's no ceiling anymore. There are no walls. It's a world without borders in that way. And I think that's what people, you know, institutions like Bang in a Can and ICE and Kronos worked so hard for. In the 70s and 80s and 90s was to break down those borders and walls so that people like me and this generation of performers and musicians didn't have to worry about it.
Yeah.
And we can focus on creating and not breaking down walls, you know? I mean, there are always walls to be broken down, don't get me wrong. But for the most part, I feel very free in my industry and being a musician. I feel like even when people say don't do that, it doesn't mean anything. It's like, don't do what and why, you know?
Yeah, and who are you?
Who are you to say? So it really, there's a lot of cross-pollination going on. Even, you know, this bleeding between genres, you know, a lot of the indie rock scene kind of collaborating and with this quote-unquote classical music scene and vice versa, you know, more traditional classically trained composers who are venturing into the singer-songwriter world, you know, and writing shorter tunes and making these kinds of transitions. I think, you know, Dave Longstreth of the Dirty Projectors, that's a good example. He actually went to Yale, I think a little before my time, and he was studying with Martin Bresnik. And I remember Martin saying, like, I'm going to leave that one alone. Like, he's doing great things and he's doing his own thing. He's doing him. and kind of, you know, so he was taking composition lessons and studying composition, mm-hmm. but yet he became this like kind of indie rock star.
Yeah, like Bryce Dessner.
Bryce Dessner is another example, and another Yale-y, actually.
Oh, really?
Everyone's from Yale. I'm gonna. So people are gonna listen to this and be like, "Yale sucks. Harvard rules," or something like that. But yeah, he's another perfect example. Being in the National, he does everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, he plays in the National and he writes with them. But I know he's also got a very strong foothold in the you know, this classical community and writing for more like chamber music and orchestra. So I think it's wonderful.
I think it's amazing. And I think it's so interesting because when you hear that music, when you hear somebody like Bryce, they're doing new and interesting things, and you're a contemporary human being, those things connect with you. And you're like, where did that come from? And then you start listening to where it came from and where that came from and then where that came from. Which brings me to kind of my last question, which is, what's the same? Because, I mean, we've got to talk about that because there is a sort of through line between like Bach and what's happening now.
Well, and thank God for that.
Yeah.
I think.
But people are playing like bowls of water now and stuff.
Right.
Like how did we get from Bach to that?
The most important things for me are awareness of tradition mm-hmm. and structure in a piece, in a composition. Like, I think structure, from my viewpoint, is a very hard thing to achieve as both a performer and a composer in your piece. And younger composers, like, you can have a lot of great ideas and great sounds. You can write a 45-minute piece, but that 45-minute piece might not have an arc or a flow, mm-hmm. or the right structure that makes it a great piece of music.
Uh-huh.
And structure comes from tradition and comes from Bach and Beethoven and Brahms and Schubert.
Yeah. Okay.
And if you want to go back even further to like Renaissance motets, what's his name? Gesualdo. Like, so you can go far, far back into whatever classical music is for you and find where it came from. So it's very important that we do look back and that we sort of incorporate. And I think it's this very slow, it's like a glacier.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I feel like music is. It's this huge glacier that's moving. We can't see it moving. It's imperceptible, but it's moving over hundreds and hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
So for everyone who's kind of going off the beaten path and experimenting and doing all sorts of different things, then there are people who are more traditionalist and there are people doing both. And it's kind of, it's inching forward and it might go back a little bit and then it inches forward some more, but always maintaining this kind of eye of the hurricane, like center about it that has both worlds. And I think that that is really important, and it's important in education, especially people studying to be in music, that we do have that tradition, which I had. The only thing I wished as a student was that I did more of the other, which more maybe improvisation, more jazz, more experimenting, and kind of it took me until, you know, later after school and joining Bang on a Can, where I began to embrace those ugly sounds that I was talking about, or embrace mistakes. There can be a lot of anxiety and pressure on like how something should sound based on what came before. And I think new music is beautiful in that it's new and it hasn't been recorded.
Nobody knows how it should sound.
So there's this freedom, and that's how I now approach older music.
Uh-huh.
Whenever I go back and play Bach or Beethoven or Brahms or any of those composers, I look at it like a new piece of music.
So this new way that you've learned how to be with music has shed a new light on this very old stuff.
And I think I just wish that those two things could merge sooner in life for people. I think they are. I think that colleges and universities and even hopefully, you know, elementary on up are becoming more aware of that and incorporating those things. Contemporary music is playing a bigger role in education. And I just want to see that happen more. And when I do visit schools or when I do teach or come and demonstrate or lecture, I like to talk about that, you know, and just encourage people to get off the page, you know, and don't spend all your time in a practice room. Go out and play with other people. Go out and talk to other people. Collaborate. Like, that's why, you know, you have so much time, you know, and everybody says, oh, enjoy it while it lasts. And you're like, ha ha, it'll always be there. And then you realize you get into real life and a professional life and you have very little time.
Yeah.
So that's what I wish I could see more of, is not mm-hmm. only that we're doing classical music and tradition, but we're also bringing as much of the new and the experimental into that kind of early platform mm-hmm. of in that those stages of development, because that's kind of where it counts. You know, it's much harder later in life to teach an old dog new tricks.
And we're back to dogs.
Yes.
Well, this has been so much fun, Ashley. Thank you so much for taking the time to come into the studio today. Have so much fun on your tour.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoy the drive down the West Coast.
Right. What is it? US 1?
101.
101. Okay. Yeah, I've never done that.
Oh my God, you'll love
it.
You
have to.
Thanks so much. All right, everyone, that does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to classicalclassroomshow.com. By the way, if you hadn't heard, our website has some awesome new features that you should go check out right now. You can download free lesson plans and study guides for many of our episodes. You can leave us a message. And if you're feeling so moved, and you probably are, I can tell, if you want to support the work that we do on Classical Classroom, you can now do so financially. Just click the little button that says Tip Jar, and we'll give you a little something in return for your efforts. As always, you can also email us at classicalclassroomshow@gmail.com. Thanks today to the home of Classical Classroom, King FM in Seattle, where we will leave those Thanksgiving leftovers in the fridge until they turn into science experiments. Thanks to our birthplace, Houston Public Media. Thanks to the official life coach of Classical Classroom, Winning with Winona, we make winners, not whiners. Thanks to Ashley Bathgate for being on the show today. Thanks to me for saying words, but most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.